Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
We've got a very full show for you today. The love couple that had an incredible deep run in this year's main event. David Doc Sands and his girlfriend Erica Moutinho will both be on the show today. They finished 30th and 29th, respectively, in this year's World Series of Poker main event. We'll talk to them about what it was like to play against each other and much more when they join us in about 10 minutes or so. Also on the show today, an update on internet poker legislation from our friend Chris Krafcik, who keeps an eye on all of that sort of stuff. There's been movement in California. There's the new online lottery poker system in Washington, D.C., and we'll talk to Chris about that, plus about how this company, Harrah's, or rather Caesars, will be handling the world of internet poker when it comes time for them to enter it, and what they're doing about getting in on the legislation to change what happened on Black Friday. Also on the show today, we introduce a new strategy segment, a poker coaching segment, with the pros from StackemCoaching.com, and we'll give you a promo code for you to get a free trial of Stack'em Coaching. John Kim, who's known online as Nicolac Poker, will join us for the inaugural coaching session from Stack'em Coaching later on in this hour. All of that ahead. I'm Paul Harrah's, here at the feature table of Harrah's St. Louis. Normally at this point I'd say hello to my partner Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. But look at this, he's sitting right next to me here in Harrah's. Welcome back home.
It feels good to be back in St. Louis, no doubt about that.
It's nice to have you here. We only have a few minutes to talk about what's going on in poker news, so let's start with the big event going on in Las Vegas, and that is the Epic Poker League, which got a kickstart this weekend and which has its main event going on now. What do you know about it?
Quite a bit, actually. They had joined together with the Heartland Poker Tour. They had their, quote, pro-am over the weekend. Ended up with 190 players playing in that. The big prize there was the top nine would each get a seat into the Epic Poker League. So you got nine of the people. That's what they were playing to. 68 of the 190 people were actually those that already had a card for the Epic Poker League.
So they were looking at this as a mega satellite.
Absolutely.
Instead of having to pay the $20,000 for the main event today, they figure, well, if I can get in for $1,500,
yeah,
that'll work.
Yeah, it's like a mega satellite. It's exactly what it is. Of the 68, Andy Block is the only one that actually made it through and got one of the seats. So Andy made it to the final table. He made it to the final six. But the others did not. Mike Maniscalco came close. I think he went out like 13th. Brian Rass went out 10th. He was the bubble boy, the second bubble boy, and barely missed the seat.
Mm-hmm.
But 68 of the members of the 252 that were eligible for it signed up for this and did play for it. Another thing they had out there is on Friday, I believe it was, they had a charity tournament hosted by Brad Garrett. They raised over $50,000 for the people in Joplin, Missouri.
Yeah, Operation USA.
Very well done on that one, too. So, and in fact, the gentleman who won it turned around and donated the entire first place prize.
That was Andy Frankenberger, who's currently the Player of the Year leader for, I think, the WPT or one. There are so many different POY lists now, but Andy's a heck of a player. Had to take it down, and like $2,500 in
right,
cash.
Right.
But there were also prizes for the top people there.
Yes.
One of the things that they did here when Andy and Jeffrey set up this charity thing was they made it so that everybody's buy-in, 100% of that, went to the charity.
Correct.
And there were rebuys, and I know you like those kind of charity rebuy
tournaments. Oh, they can be so much fun.
Because you've done it where you convinced everybody at the table to move all in on the first hand, and then you rebuy everybody in, right?
Actually, Andy and I did that several different times. We did it at the Hard Rock and some of the other ones. Andy Block, the guy that also made the final table there in the Pro-Am. I think the worst one I did was when we agreed we were going to push all in until we won a hand. And it took me 17 hands before I won one.
Whoops.
I rebought 17 times at this charity tournament. Yeah, that one got a little expensive, but, you know, hey, it was for a good cause. So, Anyhow, all did well. We'll see what happens. They're signing up as we speak. I think there's about 80 people so far in the tournament. They're hoping for at least 120 in the Epic League main event. It's a $20,000 buy-in. There is no rake. They added $400,000 to it. Two things that are hurting them a little bit for the sign-up. There's only 252 people that qualified for it, and of that, about a third of them come from Europe. And unfortunately, they were over here in June. They had the WSOP. Many of them went back to Europe, went back to their families, and are not going to participate in it for that reason.
Well, this is one of the things that you and I talked about one of the difficulties of having their very first event here in the beginning of August is a lot of bankrolls got burned at
the
WSOP.
They did.
You know, if you're a pro, it's not that hard to play a lot of events and burn through six figures.
Easily at the WSOP. I know of several pros that talk about they budget $150,000 out there, hoping not to use it all, obviously, but that's what they budget for the WSOP main event and all the other events prior to that, for the 57 events out there.
Yep.
It's a pretty good bankroll to start with, it sounds like, but you can go through it so fast out there.
Right. So, now, you said that there were 190 in
Correct.
The Pro-Am. Is that a good number for them? I mean, we're kind of in uncharted territory here because it's the first of a new concept here. I mean, yes, there's been a professional poker players league before, but essentially the Epic Poker League is something kind of new, and they have, I don't know if they have high expectations or modest expectations or whether they're meeting them. Do you have a sense of that yet?
Well, I really think they expected more here, but again, the timing is bad for this first one. Right after WSOP, they were running satellites down there at the Palms, and they got 40 people in qualified for their Pro-Am through the satellites. But they were running them in June when people were down there at the Rio. So I'm not for sure they got a very good response there because of that. They are adding $400,000 to the prize pool. So it's an equivalent of walking into day one of this Epic today and having 30 people already busted out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very nice. But when you normally go into a tournament, if you've been playing a lot of tournaments, you have a certain level of confidence, you figure you're better than the average person at that tournament, therefore there should be some dead money, should be some value to playing in that. I'm telling you, the 252 people on the list, there's not a whole lot of dead money anywhere from number 1 to 252.
This is not a fish filled frenzy.
Not even close. So it's going to be a tough tournament. And what it is, because the majority of the money went into those nine seats,
mm-hmm.
I think it took 132 players just to take that to qualify and match the nine seats.
Uh-huh.
So the first 132 players that signed up, all of their money went purchasing those nine seats. So there was some prize money. They did have 190. They paid the top 18, but not a substantial amount. The whole thing was getting down to the nine. That was where the interest was. That's where, you know, all the drama was.
So the guy who won it, Steve O'Dwyer, what did he make?
$23,000 on top of the $20,000 buy-in. So it's a $43,000 payday for him. Not bad.
Not a $1,500 buy-in.
Exactly.
That's not
exactly.
Horrible.
Right, right. It's the guys that finished 10th through 18th that cashed but barely got their money back. If you did not make the top nine, you didn't have a good value here.
Huh.
So that was where the fight was. And I can imagine, I think the cameras should have been on them from 15 players, 14 players, 13 players. That's where the interest was. When Mike Manasau was still in and went out 13th or 14th, when Brian Rass went out 10th and the bubble guy and didn't get his seat,
mm-hmm.
you know. That's where the interest was. That's where it would have been great TV, I think.
Yep.
So I wish they would have covered that a little bit more, because I think they didn't get the TV going until they got down to the final six, and most of the drama was gone by then.
Speaking of Brian Rast, tonight ESPN is going to be showing
the
$50,000 buy-in Poker Players Championship from the World Series of Poker, which was one of the best events this summer. That'll be on ESPN tonight at 7 o'clock Central Time, a two-hour show. As we know from last week's conversation with Phil Hellmuth here on the final table, Brian Rast beats him. And next week on this show, we will have Brian Rast to talk about that. It'll give us a chance to watch what happens and then talk to him about it. We kind of know because I watched it online on the night that they actually played and you were out there.
Yeah.
But we'll be able to see more about what was really going on in the hands from the TV coverage, and we'll talk to him about it next week.
And again, I've got to give kudos to Phil Hellmuth. I thought he was so candid in the show. If you didn't hear it, you need to go back and listen to that podcast.
Yes.
Because he was straightforward. He admitted when he may have misplayed hands. He gave credit to other players. I thought he did a great interview.
Yep.
The guy was totally, totally candid.
Yep.
I like that. And that's something you don't see all the time out of Phil, or didn't in the past. This guy can play poker. Make no mistake about it.
I agree 100%. And I would also add that if you've not listened to last week's show or you've missed any of our previous 131 shows, you can get them anytime by going to Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. Click on the Final Table Radio Show, and all of the shows and all of our previous guests are on there. You can also subscribe via iTunes and download the show automatically every week and catch up with shows, more recent shows that you may have missed. So we appreciate all of that, plus our live listeners here on 590 The Fan, KFNS. Now, before we get to our guests, did you hear about Barry Greenstein's automotive adventure this weekend?
No.
Barry went to play in a poker game in the San Diego area and was apparently staying at a Marriott in the Mission Hills area and brought his Aston Martin with him, an Aston Martin DB9.
Ooh, nice.
Now, I don't know cars. You know cars. You immediately said nice. I'm going to guess 200K for that car.
I have no idea. It's definitely way above where I'd be. I put too many dents in cars. I'm not going to buy that one.
Well, Barry took it to the valet.
Ooh.
And parked it with the valet. Well, what do you mean, ooh? He's not going to park it himself in the self-park parking lot.
Well, no, that's true.
Or out on the street.
And truthfully, like at the Rio, they have a little special section up front where they put cars like that. Mm-hmm. So I assume they did there, and they probably would take care of it.
Well, a guy goes up to the valet and tells him his name is Greenstein, and I don't have my ticket, but here's the license plate number of my car. And the valet gives him the Aston Martin.
Oh,
and,
my gosh.
And the guy drives away.
Was he just going for coffee?
I don't know if he was going for coffee or what it was, but later on, the guy actually came back and tried to self-park at the hotel. Hotel security spotted him, called the police. The guy was arrested. Turns out the guy had the car detailed. And brought it back to the hotel and parked it in the hotel lot. The guy's mother says he has some mental issues. Duh. He thinks it's his car.
Literally.
Literally. This is all from Barry Greenstein's tweets on Saturday night. I was here at Harris playing PLO, and I'm reading Barry's tweets and sharing them with the table, and everybody was in shock. I mean, you take a $200,000 car, you don't bring it back to the place you stole it from.
It's like robbing a bank and then going back there for change.
I have all these hundreds. Can you change some into 20s and 10s? So Barry says that he got the car back, and it's in good shape, and it was actually cleaner than when he left it.
Oh, my gosh.
But to have the car returned there is absolutely stunning, and quite an adventure for Barry, who, by the way, was a loser in the cash game that he went down there to play. Talk about running bad and then running good.
Exactly.
Getting the car back. Let's bring on our guests now. We've got David Sands and Erica Motino, who, you tell a little bit about them.
Yeah. Erica Motino and David Sands combined had 7 cashes this year at the World Series of Poker. David had a good year on top of that. He made a final table at the EPT in San Remo and at the EPT High Roller event in Madrid, and that was a tough, tough tournament. But I think they're more famous for the deep run in this year's main event. He finished 30th, and she beat him, finishing 29th.
Yep.
They won a total combined of almost $500,000. They played against each other at the TV feature table. And then right after the main event, it even got better because they got engaged.
Yeah.
So, Erica and David, congratulations, and welcome to the final table.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you having us on.
Nice to have you here. Before we talk to you about poker, David, I understand you've got a St. Louis connection through your grandmother. Is that right?
I do. I used to go there about once a year to visit her. I still go pretty regularly, maybe once every 18 months now. She used to live in Hanley Hills and just recently, about 3 months ago, moved into an assisted living facility there. I'm blanking on the name, but it's a pretty nice one that's really huge, and I'm sure I would remember the name if somebody mentioned it. But, yeah, she's 91 years old and doing really well. I talk to her regularly. She doesn't play poker, but she likes to play bridge, and I think that's her number one activity to keep her mentally sharp. So, she loves it out there. She used to go back and forth between St. Louis and Florida, but now she's there full time. So her name's Sunny Glassberg, and shout out to her.
Well, people in the St. Louis area may recognize the name Sunny Glassberg. She has been one of this town's most prominent philanthropists through the years. In fact, if you're ever driving down 40 and you see Turtle Park, Sunny paid for that.
Right. There's a turtle named after me there. There's a David Turtle. There's a turtle of all her grandkids. So I've been there many times. I was there at the dedication. I think I was about 11 or 12 years old. But, yeah, she's done some really great things for the city. She's, you know, obviously that was a huge contribution. And she's put aside some great public spaces just for public use, and also made some really generous contributions to the zoo. So St. Louis Zoo. So, yeah, she's definitely a prominent philanthropist in St. Louis, and I appreciate you mentioning that.
Well, that's wonderful, and that means, Erica, you have a turtle-in-law.
Right here.
All right. Well, let's get back to a little bit of poker. That's kind of what we were going to talk about. A couple of quick questions for you. When you were both going to be playing here in the main event, did you sign up for the same day one? How did you decide who's going to play where or sign up? And were you looking forward to getting at the same table, or were you apprehensive for being at the same table?
Well, first off, I wasn't really sure if I was going to be playing the main event. Dave wanted me to, and I wasn't 100% sold on the fact that I was ready to play. So I actually signed up for day 1D, and that was just because, you know, I didn't know if I was going to play, and I ended up registering the night before when I finally decided to just go for it. Dave usually plays day 1D, and so that's what he's been doing for the past few years, and so he was already registered for day 1D, you know, a couple weeks in advance. In terms of, you know, playing together or feeling, you know, like what would happen if we ended up at the same table, it didn't even cross my mind that would happen, because, you know, I wasn't really expecting to go that far, to be honest with you. So
I thought maybe you were expecting David to bust out and you would have to carry the load.
Yeah, we definitely weren't expecting to both be in with 30 left. So obviously the chances of being at the same table are pretty remote. But it ended up being a great story and a ton of fun for us. And, you know, I was just really happy and proud to be a part of it. So I enjoyed it a lot. It was a tremendous and unique experience. And, you know, it's pretty unlikely that I'll ever get to play on a stage that big with Erica again. But, you know, we'll both be back next year and in future years trying to make more runs. So it could always happen.
Now, Erica, you were actually at the feature table before Dave, right?
Sorry, I'm going to get Erica's right here.
Yeah, I was actually at the feature table before Dave. I got moved there midway through the day, and then interestingly enough, but with about 40 minutes left in the night, Dave got moved to the table as well. So that was our first, you know, moment at the same table, which if you see the look on my face, you know, I'm pretty surprised when he walks through the tunnel.
So particularly when he sits down on your left. If there's one guy you don't want to have position on you, not only is it the guy you're in love with, but also a really great player.
Yeah, well, that was when Dave was sitting to my direct left was the second day that we were actually at the same table, and he was there to begin with, and I got moved, you know, maybe an hour into the day. So when I saw that, you know, I was going to be sitting to his right, him to my left, you know, that's not something I wanted to even have going on. First of all, obviously, I would rather not, you know, play with him as much as I would like to play with someone else, and then he's a great player and really aggressive, so it kind of put me in an awkward situation.
Wasn't Ben Lamb at the same table too? Isn't he a friend of yours?
Ben was at the same table. Yeah, the first time I was moved to the feature table, he's a good friend of ours. We actually had dinner break that night together. So when I got moved, it was actually nice to see him there. He's really, you know, friendly and comforting, and made it a little bit easier for me since I had never really been on, you know, such a large stage before.
Talk a little bit about, Erica, I'm going to ask you this first, and then David, you can chime in. Talk a little bit about this, because, I mean, essentially you learned poker by watching Dave play, mostly online, but he also taught you and encouraged you over the course of the last year, and here you are getting into a situation where you're not only playing against each other, but you're playing against Ben and some other pretty good table opponents there. First of all, talk about the strategy of playing against each other. And secondly, what had you learned by that point about how to play a main event?
In terms of playing against each other, you know, unfortunately, we just had to look at it as if, you know, we weren't dating and we were just playing against any other opponent. So, you know, that's kind of hard just because, you know, we're in a relationship together. He taught me how to play. And so he kind of knows a lot about my game. I know a lot about his game. So that was, you know, a little bit difficult. But at the end of the day, we just had to play it as if, you know, we were playing against anyone else. In terms of, you know, playing against Ben Lamb and, you know, Eric Lingroom's at the table when I got moved and, you know, a bunch of really good players. At that point, I just took what, you know, David told me, you know, kind of from the beginning. It's just, you know, pick your spots well, play your game, stay patient, and, you know, you have to be aggressive to win the tournament. So I tried to use a little bit of the advice that he had given me and just stay calm and focused.
Well, this was your first main event, but you played at least one or two other events out there in the series this year, correct?
Yeah, this was my first main event. I played another $1,000 buy-in tournament, and I played the ladies' event this past year and the previous year. So I never played a $10,000 buy-in tournament, so it's kind of, you know, a big deal for me.
Well, you're one of the few people can say you've cashed in every one you've ever played.
Yeah.
So Dave, since you had position on Erica at that TV feature table, were you three-betting her a lot?
Well, I might have, except the stack sizes didn't really enable me to do that. I wasn't able to really three-bet anybody other than shove. On day seven, when I got moved to the feature table at the end, I played a pretty interesting hand post-flop against Eric Lindgren in the 30 minutes I was at the table. But on day eight, you know, I basically had 30 big blinds and under, so... I think I only three-bet twice that day, but I didn't move all in because, you know, I only had the stack to do it a couple times. But I didn't have any really good spots against Erica. I had one marginal spot where she raised blind versus blind, and I either had to three-bet shove or fold. But I don't know. I just felt like based on my stack size and what she knew about, you know, my willingness to reshove, that she wasn't going to be raised folding there. So I folded a semi-big hand, which I might have shoved against against an opponent that had a wider opening range, but it turned out that she had me beat. I actually folded king-queen, and she had ace-x. I don't remember what she had. She told me after she had ace-x, but I think she was raised calling. So that was kind of the only marginal spot where it was even, you know, kind of a close call where she was involved. But I think I ended up making the right decision based on the information I had against her. I don't think she was raised folding. So... it definitely was an interesting dynamic, and it was just more than, you know, us playing against each other. It was just kind of interesting because it felt like, you know, when she was in the small blind and I was in the big blind, it sort of felt to me like they were raising, like, both my blinds. You know, like, it was, like, kind of my small blind, kind of my big blind. So that was, like, the more interesting dynamic. I would just get so, like, I reshoved three different times from the big blind at that TV table. I ended up watching the coverage, and it wasn't, you know, they were alternating 30 minutes on our table, 30 minutes on the other table. So we only saw my bust hand, and then where I reshoved with Jack 10 and got called. But I reshoved 8-10 suited twice, and then 4-4 once when she was in the small blind. So I felt good about that because I felt like those were successful defends against both a small blind and a big blind steal to some extent. So that was kind of an interesting dynamic.
I mentioned before, Dave, that you've been, you know, a successful pro for years online, and you have over $1 million in tournament winnings. I wonder if teaching Erica made you a better player.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, anytime you talk about the game or, you know, try to impart your knowledge of the game just onto somebody else, you inherently improve yourself because basically you have to have a more fundamental understanding to teach someone how to do something than you do it yourself. You know, like I play a lot of golf, whether it's teaching someone to play golf or play poker or just do like a basic math problem, you just have to have a higher level of understanding to explain something to someone than you do to just repeatedly do it yourself. So I definitely think, you know, I've been teaching Erica online for about 2 years, you know, a year and a half or something like that. And, you know, during that time, I kind of recognized that, you know, there were some like reshove spots that I might have or some, you know, like strategies that I would employ with like 50 or 40 big blinds in terms of you know, four betting or five betting, that, like, I knew what I was doing on a, like, a subconscious level, but until I started actually hashing it out with Erica, I really didn't, you know, vividly think through every step of the thought process. So I also thought that was interesting how just, you know, over the course of teaching Erica, I definitely felt like my game was improved, you know, just by having to explain the smaller details, kind of the things that the thought processes that I took for granted in my head, to actually have to hash those out, I felt like helped elevate my game a little bit. And then kind of in conjunction with that, you know, just having Erica around and, you know, during my discussions with my friends who are other top players, and just having her ask good questions that, you know, maybe we wouldn't, you know, those of us who've been playing for 5 to 8 or 9 years aren't going to ask, but just having her, you know, add those refreshing questions that, you know, are maybe somewhat obvious to us, but, you know, require a little more detail. I think all those things definitely helped elevate my game in the long run.
It's a game that you can always improve on. I think you bring some very valid points there. If you've got to explain in detail to a person what you're doing and how you're doing it, it makes you rethink it to the nth degree. So I think that's excellent. I got a question for Erica here. You ended up being the last woman standing. One of the problems we've got with this sport is that we don't have enough women playing the sport. How can we, do you have any ideas on how we can get more people involved? What made you so interested in playing it and being so successful?
In terms of, you know, getting women involved in poker, I think it's just, for a lot of women, they don't feel comfortable playing with men, and, you know, they're a little bit intimidated maybe. And so I think you just have to, you know, show them that, you know, it's important to have confidence in yourself, and that, you know, men, women, you know, it doesn't matter, and everyone can be successful in the game. So it's really important to, for me at least, to show that, you know, I'm a female, I haven't been playing that long, and, you know, I was able to do really well. And so, you know, there's a lot of opportunities out there, and so, you know, they should just go for it, really. Because, I mean, I don't really think that, you know, you should say men play better, women play better, but, you know, it's all the same to me.
I think the other lesson here would be fall in love with a poker player.
Yeah, that always helps.
Well, I mean, obviously I was lucky enough to, you know, be in a relationship with someone who's already a really great poker player, and I was able to, you know, kind of pick up along the way a lot of, you know, just great tools that he had, you know, that he had taught me. So, yeah, that would definitely help as well.
Well, I think maybe he was lucky enough.
Yeah.
To be
involved in it. There you go.
All right, last question for you. You both live in Panorama Towers, which is Poker Player Central in Las Vegas, or at least it has been. We hear that a lot of young pros who were making their living online are leaving the country to be able to continue playing online from Canada or Europe or Mexico or wherever else. First of all, can you confirm that among the other Panorama Towers residents that you know? And secondly, are you two considering that?
Yeah, well, actually, that gives me a good opportunity to apologize for the background noise. Panorama is definitely like a dorm of poker players, and you might have heard my dog barking about 10 minutes ago. One of our friends just randomly stopped by and knocked on the door. So that'll happen from time to time. He's a fellow poker player, and that kind of gives you an idea of how Panorama operates. You know, it just kind of is like a dorm of freshman year, just people stopping by to say hello and whatnot. But, yeah, we're going to get a vacation home in Canada so that we can play online. Got a pretty good group of guys that's going out there in addition to Erica. Right now it looks like it's going to be Erica and myself, and then my longtime good friend Steve Gross, GBORO780 Online, who, you know, is really without a doubt the most successful online tournament player in the history of online poker. And then my other friend Jason Kuhn, Nova Sky on Full Tilt, or was Nova Sky on Full Tilt, and is Jakun 1985 on Poker Stars, and then also Tom Marchese, who just won the 2010 Card Player Live Player of the Year race. So it'd be nice to have a good cash game guy out there to give that perspective. But yeah, I think we're gonna have a really strong vacation home out there, and we're actually working on picking a place right now, and I think we're all going to be flying out there later this week. So I know, you know, virtually all of the people that I'm friendly with in Panorama have in one way or another made a move to relocate, really with the exception of Ben Lamb, because he's just primarily a live player and obviously plays really high mixed games across the street at Aria, so he doesn't really have the need to relocate. But with the exception of him, I would say literally every one of our friends is making a move to a foreign country to get their accounts back online.
Wow.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you guys coming on here. ESPN always looks for storylines, and they got a great one with you two, and you responded well, and you're representing poker well. Who knows, maybe the next reality show, instead of Erica casting it, you two will be casting it somewhere. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I think you're doing a very, very good job.
Well, thanks, guys. We appreciate that, and thanks for having us. We're always happy to come back.
Thanks.
Thank you, David, Doc Sands, and Erica Motino. 29th and 30th in this year's World Series of Poker main event. They will be the storyline with the main event coverage that begins next week and will continue right through the November 9 on ESPN. We'll take a break and we'll come back with our new poker coaching segment with John Kim from StackemCoaching.com, and we'll give you a code for you to get a free trial of that site. And then we'll talk about internet poker legislation with Chris Krafcik. As the final table continues, Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris live from Harris in St. Louis in the poker room on 590 The Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcast via iTunes and on TheChipLeader.com.
Kids, are you caught up in that old game of shuffling your debt around and hoping you'll get lucky and win the jackpot? Well, it's time to deal. Mortgage rates are low and savings are high. So stop bluffing and call 800-GRANNY-8 or go to granny8.com. You bet our friendly loan officers make it easy, and we don't have an application fee. So call 800-GRANNY-8 and you'll be holding all the aces.
Raise mortgage rates, call 800-GRANNY-8.
granny8.com.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, live from Harris in St. Louis. Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris, thank you for listening. We'll start our live PLO game here at Table 2 right after the show today. There's PLO going every day of the week. In fact, last Thursday they started playing it as a PLO 8 or better game, which I think is the first time that's happened. Maybe a regular weekly thing. I don't know. There's all sorts of other live action here, and we just found out the dates for the 2012 World Series of Poker Circuit event that'll happen here in St. Louis. That'll be April 12th through 23rd. Circle that on your 2012 calendars. That'll be 12 days, 12 rings. And details, of course, will be on the Harris website, harris.com/STLPoker. And a reminder that in a couple of weeks, on the last Saturday of this month, August 27th, they'll be having the double shootout for $10,000, a $200 buy-in. Can get you $10,000, and all you got to do is beat 18 people. Beat the 9 people at your table, make the final table. You beat those 9 people, you get the first prize of $10,000. And I think everybody at the final table probably gets paid, too.
They probably do. Can I pick the 18 I want to play?
Am I one of them?
No, you're not.
Anyway, for more information on that and everything else going on here, go to harrisstlouis.com and then come down and play with us. We'd love to have you here. Again, for the tournament schedule, it's harris.com/STLPoker. Today on the final table, we're introducing a new poker coaching segment with the pros from StackemCoaching.com. Over the next few weeks, you'll have Joe Tien and Jared Tendler and Matt McMatto Affleck will be joining us. And today we kick things off with John Kim, who is one of the pros from StackemCoaching.com, and we're happy to have you on the show. John, what do you have for us today?
Hey, guys. How's it going? Hey, today I wanted to talk about long run and understanding it and how it applies to poker and how you can profit the most from it, understanding it. There's actually a micro version and a macro version of the long run, and the macro version is just understanding what it takes to play your A game over the long run, and that involves always playing your A game consistently, tilt control, not having an ego, which most players tend to have. We all know that. Dennis can relate to me. And just always trying to improve. So that definitely helps in the long run. But I think there's a lot more weight in the macro sense of it, and some people don't seem to understand that. And the macro sense is when you play a hand, a specific hand, you have to make a decision based on the long run, not just on the immediate moment. So for example, when you're involved in a hand, you should always be looking at a hand, not what the best play is at this moment, but what's going to show the most EV expected value over the long run, over a number of trials. Like, before I get into that, I think a good analogy would be flipping a coin. You can flip it 10 times and it could come up heads, 10 times, it doesn't mean it's going to come up heads the next time. After a million trials, you get pretty much close to 50-50. And I think there's a lot of comparisons you can make into poker, because, for example, when you face a decision, the actual results of one hand shouldn't determine that you made the right play. You should look at it, okay, after a million trials of this hand or this decision, what shows the most profit? For example, yesterday I was coaching a student, and in this hand he had ace-jack, and he raised pre, got a caller, bet the flop, bet the turn. He had nothing. He had total error on a king-high board. There was two hearts. There was on the flop, third heart on the turn. River came another heart, and his read was that his opponent was pretty weak. He would have raised with the flush on the turn. So his most likely hand was like king-queen, king-jack, with maybe the jack of hearts or the queen of hearts, and he felt like he can get him to fold the hand. And there was about 200 in the pot, and I think it only takes about a half-pot bet to get the job done. So he was going to bet $100, but he chickened out at the last moment and was worried that he was going to get called. But if we look at it from the long-run view, is he would only need to get be right 1 out of 3 times, because he's getting 3 to 1 on his bet on the river. So even if he bets 100, gets called there, it doesn't mean it's a bad play, because if he does it a million times, and he felt like he's going to get a fold, you know, more than 1 out of 3 times, he's going to show a profit, and that's how he should be looking at all spots, all decisions. Is not what happened in one specific hand. And I think that's a trap that a lot of beginner to intermediate players fall into, is that they see the results of one hand and they feel that the player is correct, when they should be looking at a number of trial, a specific trial of hands, a big trial of hands. And the other aspect of it is how many number of hands it. That's hard to answer when it comes to the long run, because the long run is what it is. It is the long run, and it's over on very many hands, but you should always try to base your decisions on an infinite number of hands, what the results would be after an infinite number of hands. So I hope players can think that way, and that definitely helps in determining the best, the most profitable decision in any particular hand. Now, I quickly want to mention cash games versus tournaments and how the long run affects each and what the differences are. The reason why it, cash games seem to be a little more consistent in terms of, you know, making a profit, whatnot, is because there's a monetary result for each specific hand, whereas tournaments, it's an X number of hands for one monetary result. So that's why you have higher variance in tournaments. That's why people can win a ton of money with a short sample versus, you know, or they can lose a lot of money. And you won't see your true win rate or your ROI unless you play a lot of tournaments, and that's why there's much higher variance in tournaments. So that's why I suggest to new players want to get into poker to make money is to start off in cash games, just because there's lower variance, because you get an actual result after each specific hand instead of playing an X number of hands in tournaments. So so if you think along those lines, you can see how long run plays into, you know, the profitability of, you know, how you do in the long run. And the other thing I wanted to mention is limit poker versus no limit. I think in limit poker and live games, you can pretty get a good feel for what your win rate is after 200 to 300 hours of play. Whereas in no limit, it takes longer, because the concept of big hands, in no limit, you can lose your entire stack. Whereas in limit, you can't. So when you lose your entire stack, it takes longer to make up. Right. So in no limit, I think a good win rate, say at 2.5, would be about 5 dBs per hour, which would be $25 an hour. So if you lose 100 dBs in a hand, which is about the standard buy-in, I guess, in most places, you lose 500, so that would be about 20 hours you're losing in profit. So it takes a lot longer to achieve, to find out your true long-run win rate in no limit versus limit hold'em, or in any variation.
Some pearls of wisdom there from John. I'm trying to learn this. I guess the bottom line is, if you can analyze your hand and you make the right play, and you can actually be honest with yourself that you've made the right play, that definitely would help here.
And thinking about it all as one big game in the long run. John Kim, one of the pros from StackemCoaching.com, where you can rethink poker and learn from the pros. You want a free trial? Use the promo code FINALTABLE when you log on to StackemCoaching.com. John, thanks for your time today.
All right, thanks a lot, guys.
More coming up next week and every week here on the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Paul Harris and Dennis Phillips. Now let's bring in our expert on Internet poker legislation, and that is Chris Krafcik, who's an independent research analyst who works for gambling industry publishers and consultancies around the world. Chris, let's jump right into it. We hear that there's been some movement in California on iPoker legislation. What can you tell us?
Unfortunately, there hasn't been. The legislative session right now is on recess, and I think they're set to reconvene around August 15th. And the vibe in Sacramento when I last checked in, which was maybe a week or so ago, was essentially that the large issues that had divided the politically powerful Indian tribes that are driving the Internet poker debate still exist, and that the ball there really hasn't moved forward appreciably. I think what we've seen really in the mainstream media are some gambling industry people, and then also some local papers, I guess, taking kind of more of an editorial interest in Internet poker regulation in California. I think every year around this time, there's kind of some hype and speculation in the mainstream media about what's going to happen there, because it's, you know, Internet poker is touted as a budget fix. It's touted as a multi-billion-dollar proposition, which it may very well be. But as far as actually remedying the larger political issues that continue to divide the Native American tribes, nothing really substantive has happened there since 2008.
Okay. Well, if not in California, I mean, there's been a legislature or potential legislature in New Jersey and Florida and here and there and everywhere.
Sure.
What states are moving forward or are trying to get something accomplished?
Well, I think on a smaller scale, what you're seeing now, and this may or may not interest poker players, but it can in a kind of indirect way, is that state lotteries really have taken a much more keen interest than this in Internet poker and Internet gaming than ever before. I think what Paul mentioned at the top of the show was that there is, yes, some movement in Washington, D.C., where the local lottery, the district lottery there, is mulling when and whether to introduce an Internet gaming scheme, and that scheme does include poker. However, there's definitely been some public relations trouble there in terms of not only residents but local action groups and even members of Congress kind of getting a little chafed at the fact that the Internet poker proposal that was introduced in Washington, D.C. was included kind of stealthily in a budget bill last January. And so only this spring did some of the provisions in that bill start to come to light, and then once those provisions started to come to light, then some of the backlash started. And so what D.C. Lotteries decided to do, rather than launch in July as it was originally intended, now it's holding kind of public hearings after the fact with lawmakers and with residents to kind of sort out the societal, economic, and ethical implications of introducing Internet poker there. So I think now their plan is to actually start operating maybe free-to-play blackjack, maybe some poker. I'm not sure exactly what yet, but I know that the soft launch date, I think, is on October 1st. So I guess we'll see what happens there. I think they're probably the closest state or federal district in the U.S. to go forward with anything Internet gaming or Internet poker related. But you've got some state lotteries that are making noise this year about doing Internet programs. Some state lotteries think that those are just limited to lottery tickets. Others are actually interested in kind of branching out to doing poker and casino games. And as you can probably imagine from the industry side, there's probably a lot of commercial and even tribal casinos that are most displeased with the ambitions of the state lotteries to actually kind of get maybe out of their depths and into Internet poker and gaming. So going to be an interesting time here to see what happens, I guess, in the next few months. But as far as actual operations, some place to play that's legal in the United States, Washington, D.C. Will probably be the first.
Yeah, but I hear it's not going to be that great, even if it is more than just free money, play money.
Yeah.
They're talking about limiting your buy-in each week to $250. That's not going to get any poker pros moving there. I guess,
no.
I guess maybe they think that, you know, they can get some recreational players who want to play small games to play online. But also, you've got a base of only 600,000 people living within the borders of Washington, D.C. itself. They can't play in Virginia and Maryland, the suburbs. 600,000 people, if 1% of those people play, that's only 6,000 players.
Right.
How many of those are going to be logged on at any one time? You're not talking about good games.
No, you're not talking about good games. You're not talking, and as much credit as I get to the D.C. Lottery for trying to find a novel budget fix for the district. I mean, there's just... commercially, it's not a very sensible move. You know, I think at this point that the motivation was really to find some way to make more money for the district. But, you know, once we're drilling deeper into the kind of nuts and bolts of how internet poker actually works in terms of liquidity and in terms of needing a large base of players from which to draw, and then also, as you guys know, you know, a large range of games on offer, because not everybody can play $5. You know, some guys like to play, you know, penny stakes. So obviously D.C. is not the ideal or even a good commercial environment for internet poker. So I think your point's well taken, Paul. I think you're right on the money.
What about New Jersey? I mean, they even had a bill that they got in front of the governor's desk.
Yeah,
and everything
since
right. Totally died down there. So what's going on in New Jersey?
New Jersey right now, it's kind of interesting. There's a lot I was told recently on the record, which I can't repeat, but what I can say...
Yes, you can. Nobody's listening. Go ahead.
Nobody's listening.
It's not like anybody's taping this.
Right. what I can say is that what happened last year, in a nutshell, and I think as a lot of players and listeners probably know, is that you're right, Dennis, the internet gaming bill there, which was sponsored by State Senator Lesniak, got as far as the governor's desk, and the governor decided to veto it on arguably very sketchy grounds, which I won't even go into right here. But in essence, you know, the debate among Lesniak and his supporters has been since is that if we don't have the governor's support and the governor has veto power, what can we really do? And so what I was told essentially by some of the lobbyists that support internet gambling in New Jersey is that Christie is in a much weaker position now politically than he was 5 or 6 months ago. And the feeling is that there's some hope that if internet gambling legislation is introduced again in January, that it will pass quickly and that Christie will not have really much leverage to say no. And really the behind-the-scenes battle in New Jersey, as you guys probably know, took place mostly between some of the offshore internet poker operators based in the Caribbean, some of the local casino operators in New Jersey, and so they were kind of on one side. And then you had Harrah's principally and its ally Boyd Gaming, and then they were kind of teamed up with Governor Christie. And essentially what Harrah's was telling Governor Christie was saying, listen, there is a federal bill that we want to get passed, and we want some time to do that. And, you know, in that time, if something comes up in New Jersey, you know, we want you to consider vetoing it because we want to have our chance to do what we want to do in the federal government. And what we plan to do federally will somehow in the end benefit New Jersey much more than an in-state-only bill would. And so Christie went along with that, much to Lesniak's dismay, and that's sort of where we are now. And I know that Lesniak, who I haven't actually talked to in a month or so, but I know that he is actually working on plans now to reintroduce that legislation probably early next year after the statewide elections. So let's say Washington, D.C. actually doesn't get off the ground. My dark horse pick for, 2012, I think is the year next year, would be New Jersey. Yeah.
You mentioned Harrah's. I've got to ask you about the parent company, Caesars, which announced its second quarter earnings today. And I know you listened in on the conference call. I don't want to go into earnings before taxes and all that sort of stuff. But I'm curious if Gary Loveman, who is the CEO of Caesars Entertainment, had anything to say in the conference call about the corporation pushing for internet poker and how ready they are to spring when it is available in the United States.
Well, I think Loveman was very tactful in what he said about internet poker regulation. And I think what his message essentially to his investors was that he's getting the sense, and this is a paraphrase, that the tide is turning toward internet gambling regulation in the federal government. He said that more members of Congress now are kind of in line with the idea that internet gambling should be regulated for various reasons. You know,
let me just interrupt you. Internet gambling or internet poker specifically?
No, I think that's a great question. To paraphrase Loveman accurately, he was talking about internet poker specifically. His company at present does not support regulation of broader forms of internet gaming like slots and blackjack and all that other stuff. And so what he said essentially was that Congress, at least he feels, and his cadre of lobbyists, I guess, also feel that internet poker regulation, the tide is turning there, that members of Congress are probably more open now than they've ever been, and that it's not a question of if so much as it is when. And I think what's great about that from a PR perspective is it doesn't really commit Loveman to anything. It stokes investor interest. It sells the story of Caesars flotation at some point down the road. It enhances its market valuation because the market believes that, you know, internet poker is going to be a big, big part of Caesar's future in the United States. And, I mean, I can't argue with that. But what Loveman didn't really give much away on is kind of, you know, his company's preparations and specific plans that they had for internet poker in the United States. I mean, those are all proprietary details that I'm sure he doesn't want his competitors figuring out, who were probably also listening in on the conference call to see what he had to say. So I think what Loveman offered was a bit of hope, but I think from a cynical point of view, which I hear from other lobbyists that aren't under retainer by Harris, is that this remains a multi-year political issue and that the best hope of something getting done this year or even in the current session rests with the combination of Senator Kyle and Senator Reid, and that those guys coming to some sort of consensus on what a piece of legislation would look like for internet poker and then finding some way to attach that piece of legislation to an unrelated piece of legislation that may feature as part of this super committee and the debt negotiations. But as we all know, the Tea Party and its insistence on no new taxes is going to be a pretty stiff political obstacle to introducing something like internet gambling, which is which does introduce new taxes on corporations and even on players. So I would expect there to be some pushback from Tea Party and even conservative Republicans who are very anti-tax at the moment. So we'll see what happens. It should be an interesting fall. But as Loveman said today, the prospects for 2011 and 2012, the current congressional session, really aren't that great. And so I wouldn't be surprised as the year comes on to see him come out and say something more to the effect of, you know, we're looking maybe past the current session where Democrats might be back in control of the House of Representatives. I mean, as we all know, who knows what's going to happen with all that. So yeah. I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens this fall.
Well, I've got another question, a little bit same area. They've launched this Fair Play USA.
Sure.
You know, is that a legitimate for the poker players' advocacy? Is it competing with the PPA, or is this more or less just a way for Harris and the bigger MGM to, you know, get their opinion or the way they want it out there?
I think what you, the last point that you said, it was, is it a way for Harris and MGM and some of the bigger Las Vegas players to get their message out there? I think that's really the idea. If I read a lot about Fair Play USA when it first came out. What's interesting is that they are, it's simply a public awareness campaign. They're not actually doing any direct lobbying of lawmakers. And so I know that the corporate backers obviously are Caesars and MGM. And as far as it actually would compete with the PPA, I don't think it really does. I think it's sort of maybe a more American, and well, let me explain this. I think maybe it's a little bit more of an American PR alternative to the Poker Players Alliance, because as we all know, the Poker Players Alliance was funded in part by a lot of the big offshore internet poker operators that no longer are in this market. And so what, if I had to speak on Caesars and MGM's behalf, is simply that, you know, the American gaming industry needs an American poker voice. And it's not going to get that through the American Gaming Association, simply because maybe the politics within the American Gaming Association are just too complicated because of the membership. And so my guess is that given the complexity within the AGA and also given maybe some broader political distaste for the PPA, given its funding situation, that Caesars probably felt it appropriate to introduce, again, a more American-feeling PR campaign for internet poker. And so is it legitimate? I think it's only as legitimate as the players that sign up make it. I think one of the great successes of the PPA is that it has over 1 million members and that it has done some great advocacy work. And I think that in terms of Fair Play USA making as much of a dent as PPA has, at least on the public relations and the government relations front, I think it's got tall shoes to fill, but I think it's definitely doable. And, you know, I think another question has to be asked among players, which is, you know, are you looking for an alternative to the Poker Players Alliance, and is Fair Play USA what you're looking for? That I really don't know. I haven't checked in on the forums and how players are responding, but I imagine that's kind of an interesting internal debate among people that actually play the game or are having now.
All right, Chris, it's always a pleasure. We appreciate your expertise. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, guys, thanks so much for having me back. Great to be here.
All right.
Chris Krafcik, who's an independent research analyst working for gambling industry publishers and consultancies around the world, joining us here at the final table. Dennis, before we go, we want to congratulate the three new inductees into the Women
yes.
in Poker Hall of Fame, an organization you've supported for years. Christy Gazes, who was a friend of ours, I think 2 years ago at the World Series of Poker, she sat down with us in an interview, and you can find that in our archives on thechipleader.com. Also, Phyllis Caro. By the way, Christy's a live tournament pro, over $1 million in earnings. Phyllis Caro, who runs poker at the Hollywood Park Casino in Los Angeles and has been in the business for more than 3 decades. And Margie Heinz, who runs poker at the El Dorado Casino in Reno and was the first woman to ever deal at the World Series of Poker in 1977. They are the new inductees this year into the...
Wonder if she got tipped. Oh, never mind.
They're the new inductees into the Women in Poker Hall of Fame. And we're all out of time. Dennis is back on the road, but will join us next week when we'll also talk with Jeffrey Pollack about the Epic Poker League. And Brian Rast, the guy who will be the winner of the event you'll see tonight on ESPN. Spoiler alert, he wins the 50K Poker Players Championship. For Dennis Phillips and all of our guests and our sponsors, I'm Paul Harris, live from Harris, St. Louis, every Tuesday at 3 with the final table on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com, and those podcasts on iTunes and thechipleader.com.